ॐ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सहवीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। ॐ मे ब्रह्मन् प्रोटेक्ट अस बोथ, मे ब्रह्मन् बेस्टव अपॉन अस बोथ the fruit of knowledge. May we both obtain the energy to acquire knowledge. May what we both study reveal the truth. May we cherish no ill feeling toward each other. Om, peace, peace, peace be unto all. In our last class we had discussed one very important point. No man can jump out of his skin and progress towards a higher stage for which he is not prepared. All of us have to practice spiritual disciplines from where exactly we are and gradually progress to the next stage. In the next chapter, Swami Vivekananda deals with a most marvelous concept. We help ourselves, not the world. Those of you who have read the Karma Yoga or even the Bhagavad Gita, which emphasizes this Karma Yoga, feel very much that we have to help others, we have to help the world. Even Sri Ramakrishna says, you know, serve the world as though it is a manifestation of God. The word service means that you are not doing any good to yourself, but you are doing good to other people. This is a totally false idea. The world doesn't need my help or your help or anybody's help. Not only in spiritual life, but also in so-called worldly life, we do not help anybody else. Have you not noticed that parents, how much they pray for the welfare of their children, how hard they work, not only human beings, but even animals, birds. Don't you see the parent birds, how much they had to struggle to feed their young chicks? There was a wonderful film by David Attenborough, and he was showing about the penguins and the females. It is the males which rear the chicks. And the females, they had to go into the sea, and for months together they are there gathering food and storing it in their stomach, that is their fridge. And while coming back, some of them fall victims to these seals, killer seals, other predatory animals. And then you see, by the time they return, the chicks are already growing up, and they had to travel at least 40 to 50 miles just carrying all that food, hurrying up to feed their chicks. And when I saw that, I felt, you know, there is a verse in Chandi, Ya Devi Sarvabhuteshu Matra Rupena Samsthita. Salutations again and again to the Divine Mother who manifests in the form of motherliness in every being. So, parents work very hard for the, so they think we are doing our duty. What is our duty? It is to bring up the children, to educate them, and to do their best. Are they really helping the children? Can anybody be helped in this world? Has your parents helped you in any way? No, they only helped themselves. What is the help? If you being parents, you are helping, apparently, doing your duties, of course. You are looking after your children, apparently helping other people. But what exactly are you doing? You are helping yourselves. In what way are you helping yourselves? Your innate divinity, your spiritual nature, is being gradually manifested in the way of looking after other people. First of all, as they say in America, you know, the happiest day in a married life is just the day before the actual marriage. Or as the other cliche goes, I did not know what happiness was until I was married. By that time it was too late. You see, the whole marriage, married life, is a struggle. But what is it teaching us? Teaching us how to adjust with other people, how to love others in spite of the differences, how to develop the tremendous patience. It is very easy. If somebody is lovable, it is very easy to love. What is your greatness? If somebody, something is very beautiful, it is natural for you to like it. What is your greatness? If something is not lovable, then it really requires saintliness for you. You know, in a village, there was a blind fellow, and he was married to one of the very ugly women in the village. And they continued. He was very happy with his married life for many, many years. In course of time, medicine had developed to such an extent. Now they are in a position to cure his blindness. So somebody suggested, this fellow had been blind for so long, should we not take him and then remove his blindness? A wise man in the village said, foolish fellow, don't do any such thing. You will break up the marriage. You see, a householder's life, it is the greatest teacher of breaking selfishness. We are all born selfish. And it is not easy to get rid of the selfishness. As soon as a man is married or a woman is married, then they have to share with each other. And after some time, children will come. So, more amount of, you know, sharing with each other. Caring and sharing and loving. Not because there are anyone is saint, but in spite of all those defects and problems and all that. And householder's life also, it is a great teacher, teaching us. Everybody has to undergo some periods of happiness and some periods of unhappiness. There is no way one can be happy or unhappy all the time. When we are happy, time passes very quickly. When we are unhappy, what do we do? Then we have to learn our lessons that in this world, no happiness comes alone. It always comes with its inseparable companion called misery. Swami Vivekananda used to say, happiness always comes with a crown of misery on its head. Only we don't see the head, we only see the tail. Worldly life has many lessons for us to teach. And if somebody hasn't done his duty properly and has not progressed to the next stage, he can never be a monk. You know, in India, there's the thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of monks. Do you think they are really monks? Many of them are escapists. Who will go to the trouble of earning all this money and looking after the family? In India, you know, if you put on an orange cloth, then your food will be there. Somewhere you can take shelter. You do not need to do any work. So I heard a funny incident, you know. There was a festival going on in India. One ordinary householder, he happened to see an orange cloth and he liked it very much and put it on. And then he went to attend the festival. And it was overcrowded. There was no place for other people to enter. But as soon as they saw this orange cloth, they made way for him so he could go inside. You know, that sentiment is there. Swamis or sadhus, holy people, whoever puts on this dress, they will not go unfed. Somebody or other will be foolish enough to feed them. Householder life has many things to teach. So who is being helped? We are being helped. Gradually, the life is teaching us, sometimes gently by hand, sometimes with a rough hand, shaking or dragging, but all the time life is taking us towards God. Swami Brahmananda, he made a wonderful statement that, believe me, God is taking everyone to his lotus feet, even a murderer. We may be surprised. Is a murderer really going towards God? Yes, he is going towards God. Why? Because you see, he murders because he thinks that is the way for his happiness. God means happiness. All of us seek happiness. But he is taking a wrong way. But God will also take him, because nobody is without divinity. Nobody can be taken away from his divinity. If it is true, if we are all potentially divine, our potentiality will not allow us to keep quiet. You cannot be other than what you really are in your true nature. So even a murderer, even a thief, even an immoral person, even a wrongdoer, wicked person, all will go towards God. But sometimes they will have to go a little long distance. There was a man who wanted to go to a village. And he was going. The road was clear. Suddenly the road forked into two ways. One was going completely to the left. Another was going completely to the north. Then he did not know which way to take to reach the village he wanted to go. There was a cowherd boy grazing his cows. So the traveler asked him, "My boy, I want to go to such and such a village. Which is the right way?" The boy said, "You can take both roads. Both roads lead to the same village." "Oh, is it so? Then what is the difference?" Well, the difference is, if you take the right side road, it is only 3 miles. But if you take the left side road, it is 300,000 miles. But you will reach the same village." An evildoer is such a person who takes a longer time. And life teaches us, you know, when we are unhappy, miserable, and under straitened circumstances, know for certain, if this is the effect, the cause also must be there. And we should take the blame upon ourselves, the responsibility. I am responsible. So in this chapter, Swami Vivekananda is telling us, those who want to practice karma yoga, they must understand an important principle, that whatever we are doing, it is only to help ourselves, not to help the world. Apparently to help the world, but really to help ourselves. Before considering further how devotion to duty helps us in our spiritual progress, let me place before you in a brief compass another aspect of what we in India mean by karma. Karma means really an action. Anything is an action. A thought, a word, and an action. All these three fall under the category of karma. And all these three, they affect us in some way. Because that is karma or action, the action must yield its result. If you think an idle thought, say you are thinking of killing somebody, you won't actually say anything about it, you won't actually do it, but you just think and you feel, "Oh, it is only just a thought." But that thought also will some way affect your life. If, so for example, you are not harming anybody, you read a nightmarish book at night, and you have a nightmarish dream. And will it not affect you? Your sleep is disturbed. Your blood pressure also may go up. And the next day, the residual effects of this dream might still continue. You know, there are people who dream stupid dreams. There was one man, and he was to travel by a plane. And previous night he had dreamt that there was a plane crash. Now, of course, he went by the plane. But don't you think that dream had an effect upon his travel? All the time, You must be thinking, maybe this is my plane, maybe this I am going to crash. So, one important aspect Swami Vivekananda is bringing up in this chapter, before we deal with the subject we help ourselves, not the world. What is it? In every religion, there are three parts: philosophy, mythology, and ritual. Philosophy, of course, is the essence of every religion. Mythology explains and illustrates it by means of the more or less legendary lives of great men, stories and fables of wonderful things, and so on. Rituals give to that philosophy a still more concrete form, so that everyone may grasp it. Ritual is in fact concretized philosophy. Every religion contains these three: philosophy, mythology, and ritual. And none of us are free from these three. If you ask an ordinary man on the street, "Are you a philosopher?" he would certainly say no. "But have you any philosophy?" he would say no. But each one of us have a philosophy. What is the philosophy? Worldly people say this world is real. Therefore, enjoy this world. Try to make the best of this world. That is his philosophy. If he is a spiritual person, says, "I believe in God. There is a higher world. There is a better life. I believe in it. Therefore, I will have to do my best to attain to that." This is his philosophy. Nobody is without any philosophy. Knowingly or unknowingly, all of us are philosophers. Either worldly philosophers or spiritual philosophers. Philosophy means what we believe life to be and what is our goal. Suppose somebody says, "I have no philosophy." But if you ask him, "What are you doing?" "Well, I go and work in an office." "What for?" "Well, to earn money." "What for?" "Well, so that I can have a good house, good family, and be happy." He has a definite philosophy. And philosophy by itself, it is always expressed in the form of mythology. What is mythology? The lives of great people, saints, sages, so far as spirituality is concerned. But no, supposing a person is a political philosopher, what is his mythology? Great statesmen, great politicians, they will be his guidelines, they will be inspiring him. Suppose a person is a musician, his philosophy is he wants to become a great musician. That is his goal in life, and his goal in life indicates what his philosophy is. So, if you ask him, "Do you believe in mythology?" "Oh, mythology, cock and bull stories." "But what about Beethoven's life?" "Oh, marvelous. I read every day his life, and I get inspired by his life." Supposing there's a pickpocket. What is his philosophy? Pick the pockets of other people in the best way that is possible. What is his mythology? He will find out who are the greatest pickpockets in the world, and he would be inspired. And supposing there is a boy, especially American boys, what is every American young boy will have this baseball, these tall American blacks, they are greatest baseball players. Basketball players, their pictures are adoring all the walls. He gets inspired by that. Suppose you ask a young English girl that, "What is your philosophy?" "No, I never thought about it. I have no philosophy." You go into visit her room. What is her walls made up of? What is that, Brittany something? The walls are covered with the pictures of celebrities. So she has a philosophy. She wants to be something like that. All of us have philosophies. How do we understand? What type of books do you read? What type of stories inspire you? And what are you thinking? What are your dreams? So that is how you find out what is your philosophy in life and what inspires. Mythology simply means the legends, the philosophy realized by some great people. It could be musicians, it could be scientists, It could be anybody. Religious people, of course. So those stories or legends, they are the mythology. In India, in every religion, but in India, you know, everybody is a Vedantist. Every boy, and he knows all the Vedanta philosophy. So what happened to your grandmother? She died in the morning, but noon he is going to attend a cricket game. What happened to your grandmother? Oh, she died in the morning. Are you not unhappy? No, no, it is karma phala. She is gone. She will be reborn again. So, if I wait for her, this cricket game will not happen again, you see. This is once in a lifetime chance. So, grandmother will be reborn many times. Philosophy. You ask every poor man in India, what is your philosophy? Everything God does. Oh, so are you rich enough? No. Can you feed 4 or 5 people in your family? No. Why are you having so many children? So what shall I do? So God has given. You marry and you beget children and you give the responsibility to God. You know, there was a householder, he had a marriageable daughter and he wanted to find some suitable husband. So they found out a young man who seemed to be right person. So the father-in-law went to interview and he interviewed the boy, came back, and his wife asked him, "Did you see the boy? What is your impression?" He said, "Yes, yes, I had a talk with him. There are good news and bad news." "What is the bad news?" "Bad news, I asked him, but what about your education?" He said, "No, no, I leave it to God." "So what about if you get married to my daughter, how will you look after her?" "I leave it to God." "So if children come, what will you do?" "I leave it to God." So everything he said, "I leave it to God, I depend upon God." So the wife asked, "Then what is the good news?" The man said that this good news is, he has a very high opinion of me. He thinks I am God. So Indians, you know, they go on talking about karma and karma phala and all those things. Vedanta, this world doesn't exist. But they are prepared to cheat, to take bribes, to do, even, you know, so many of our devotees also take bribes. This sort of nonsensical thing, talking one thing and doing another thing, has become. But the point is, how did they get this most marvelous philosophical view? Whatever they are talking is absolutely right. It is the truth. How do they get? Through mythology. How? You know, dramas, cinemas, religious pictures, and then what we call, you know, Harikathas in South India, is Mahabharata, Ramayana. They influence tremendously Indian psyche. So go on reading about these stories. Go on hearing about these stories and the teachings of great people like Ramakrishna, Vivekananda, Ramana Maharshi, Aurobindo, great souls like this. So somehow they get spread through this so-called mythology. Mythology is not cock and bull stories. They are concrete illustrations of the legends, the stories, the incidents of these great people. Of course, you know, there is, human beings are very credulous. So they go on liking miraculous stories. Suppose there is a great soul called Ramana Maharshi and his biography is presented in a beautiful way, but no miraculous. It is a very dry reading. But you read the autobiography of a yogi and practically every second page you get a miracle. And it becomes what is called a bestseller in the world. You know, we are credulous people. I am not saying the book is bad. What I am saying is, we actively seek for miracles. What is miracles? So we have got what we call lottery ticket mentality. We don't want to do anything, that we just call on God and He will come and do everything for you. He will make butter and put it for you inside your stomach and digest it for you also. This is lottery ticket mentality. Mythology forms a very important part of our life, and those countries and that society which unfortunately rejects this mythology, it turns out to be very miserable society. Look at the present day society, whether it is in the East or in the West. Even credulous people reading miraculous things, they have a better opportunity to turn out better people than these so-called people who reject it outright. Those who read great scriptures, great mythologies, and listen about them, hear about them, because that is also action, karma. This karma will not go in vain. It will may take some time. It will seep, maybe slowly, to the unconscious, and then one day it will come up. You see, all of you have come here to listen to my talks or Swami's talks. And many times you notice that I am not speaking anything new. The same truth again and again and again, I am repeating it. Of course, there is nothing much more than repetition of, there is only the whole truth in the whole world can be summarized into half a sentence. God alone is real, everything else is unreal, and you are that God. If you understand this, you don't need to hear any lecture, read any scripture. But we need to listen, to read, to think again and again and again, until it transforms our reactions. And otherwise, knowledge remains only in the upper part here, and it never comes down into practical expression. So, of course, different stories in the form of, you know, incidents we narrate, these inspire us. So, that society which is influenced by the repetition of these mythologies, it has a better chance of becoming a better society than others, those who do not. Just in a passing way, I remark to this. You know, at one time in Russia, in China, they completely, what you call, abrogated this religious idea. God is, religion is an opium of the people. God is a myth created by invested priests and all those things. Look at the people, what has happened. They were the most miserable people, even what is called worldly wise, economic wise. They have not developed, only now they have opened their eyes. You know, China and India are the most fastest growing economies today. India, of course, we can understand it. Why China? There is one important reason for that. You know, China repressed itself very much, and the result was more than 50 million people had to die for the mistake of some of those philosophers. And yet they were not free from mythology. You know what mythology they would impose? They would say, you read this life story of Mao Zedong. Again and again reinforce those ideas. Only state-controlled cinema, state-controlled books, state-controlled fiction, everything that reinforces their own philosophy. That they have not, you know, magnify the images of these great people. There is also a curious psychological conditioning. Supposing an ordinary man or woman, and you would not take notice of this person if you meet that person on the street. But the moment you see that person on the TV screen a few times, and then, you know, everybody goes gaga over it. And in the airport or in the bus stand or in the train station, oh, this is so, this is so, this is so. The influence of the stupidity, you know. I tell you, a very interesting incident was there, you know. It's very few people know me. But once, you know, one day, after 2-3 years back, after Swami Vivekananda's birthday, telephone call after telephone call. What was the matter? That day, this Asian Network Radio had asked me to speak about Swami Vivekananda. They heard about it. It's just four or five minutes interview by telephone talk. And people have heard about it. And they started phoning, "Oh, Swami, we are so glad to hear you." They never cared to phone me before that. You know, the power of the media is tremendous. What does the media do? It's a kind of mythology. It builds up a kind of halo. It reinforces the impression. But the same effect can be done by reading a book again and again, by meditating, by hearing about it. This is how we progress either towards good things or towards bad things. So nobody can escape mythology. Every nation, every individual has to take recourse. Philosophy expresses itself in an understandable way through mythology. But unless mythology is also put into concretized action, it will not affect. So what the next step is what you call rituals. There are so many kinds of rituals. Every religion is full of rituals. And there are varieties of rituals. There are economic rituals. There are political rituals. And there are religious rituals. There are spiritual rituals. All sorts of rituals are there. One example let me give you. Supposing two politicians are competing for an election. And one of them wins. And immediately, you know, there is this sign comes. You know what is this? Victory. It's a political, it's a ritual. And they go on doing this even before they are elected to enforce into the people, "We are going to win, so better be in the winning party." Economically successful people, what is this? A young man wants to impress a young woman. What does he do? He travels in a BMW 5 times in front of her. That's an economic, you know, ritual saying, "I am well endowed. So you better do to fall in love with me." I will give you another example. Suppose you see an Indian and he is going. Suddenly he sees a tree, banyan tree. And beneath that banyan tree, there is one ant hill. So immediately he prostrates before that. And we, educated people, ridicule him and say, "Oh, this fellow is a stupid fellow. He is prostrating in front of ant hill, in front of a tree and all those things." No. He is also making a ritual, his philosophy. What is his philosophy? The whole world is a symbol of God. I will give you a better illustration than this. But you see, a man who is falling in front of an idol, he is not a stupid person. He is not unintelligent. He knows very well this is a stone, or this is just an image, this is an icon. But still he does it because that particular stone, not any stone, but that particular stone, that particular image, that particular icon, evokes in him a feeling of divinity. You see so many stones here. Does it evoke any divinity within you? It doesn't. Let me give a beautiful illustration. You know, Sri Ramakrishna's father, one day he went to another village. He was coming back. He was tired. He was lying under a tree and he slept and he had a dream. In the dream, he saw the Lord Rama appearing and said, "I am lying here, uncared for so long. Why, you please, I am hungry, I am thirsty. Why don't you take me and look after me?" And he also showed the place. And Sri Ramakrishna's father woke up and he immediately looked around, saw the place which was indicated, went there, and then you know what he found? There was a hole in the ground. And in the ground, there was a small stone, it's called Saligrama, and a snake was guarding that. But fearlessly, he put his hand there, and the snake disappeared. He brought out that stone, and he examined it. It bore the signs of is real Shaligram, and it is still there being worshipped. Devotees can see it. In his eyes, it is not an ordinary stone. Anybody can make that stone. No, you can't make. It must be a natural stone. It is usually found in Narmada rivers and other rivers. But it evokes in him, because of tradition, it doesn't evoke that response in among Christians, among Muslims, among other religionists, or not even among other Hindus who worship different deities. Only the followers of that particular deity, immediately it evokes a feeling of divinity. This is God himself. Are they worshipping stones? No. But this is a ritual. They worship it. They bathe it. They prostrate before it. They do arati and all those things, as we do in the shrine room. This is nothing but a picture of Sri Ramakrishna. But we do it. So what is the philosophy behind it? The philosophy behind it is, this whole world is a symbol of God. It is a manifestation of God. Is it true? Yes, it is true. How do we know? Because great people like Sri Ramakrishna, great people like Krishna, great people like Jesus Christ, they had shown through their example what they did. And we are also following the same thing. For example, those of you who have read the life of Sri Ramakrishna, you know, in earlier days, he was practicing spiritual disciplines. Naturally, he would go to the temple, he would bow down, he would do arati, sing songs, etc. Then came a time when he had realized the truth. And he need not have gone to any temple, because he could see God everywhere, anytime, all the time. There was no need. But even then, he was going to the temple. He was very religiously, if somebody offers holy prasad, he would remove his shoes before receiving the prasad. And he will touch it to his forehead. And he will put it in his mouth. Why was he doing it? Is it necessary for him to do it? Because he had already reached the goal. But why was he doing it? So that people like us, we would not go astray. He was setting an example. Until we reach the goal, we need certain helps. As Sri Ramakrishna used to say, until the building is complete, the scaffolding is very necessary. Sri Ramakrishna used to give very ordinary day-to-day examples. You know, sometimes you have an injury, and slowly the injury is getting healed, and then the skin forms a scab, do you know? And the scab, it is in such a way, 50% is coming out, 50% is still sticking, and it is producing irritation. What do? You catch hold of that scab and forcibly remove it. Sri Ramakrishna used to say, that's not good, because it will take longer time for you to get healed. It is that scab is there to protect you so that you heal yourself. Once the body heals itself, you do not need to remove the scab. It falls by itself. Similar way, you don't renounce rituals. Rituals will renounce you. When you have reached such a stage, you do not need any rituals, then you throw them away. There is no more any need for them. In life, rituals evoke those feelings in a concrete way. Now, Vedanta philosophy tells us, Brahman is the only reality. God is the only reality. So if that is a truer statement, this table, these chairs, all of us, the trees, the buildings, the curtains, the doors, the windows, everything must be Brahman only. If you believe that Brahman alone is real, then you are forced to say this is also Brahman, nothing but Brahman. So that was the understanding Hindus, Vedantists got from this Vedanta philosophy. So for them, mountains are manifestations of God, rivers are manifestations of God, trees are manifestations of God, animals are manifestations of God, birds are manifestations of God. Of course, every human being is a manifestation of God. So what is a ritual? A ritual is that which brings us closer to this realization. That type of activity which evokes that feeling of truth within us, that is a ritual. Ritual is a sacrament. Every evening we do the vesper service to Sri Ramakrishna. It is a ritual. What is it? It evokes in us the living presence of Sri Ramakrishna. We are not waving lights to a dead picture. There is a colored picture there and we are waving lights. No. We are waving lights so that we can bring within us that living presence of Sri Ramakrishna. Even words that we are uttering are symbols. It is impossible to live a life without symbols. So this is what Swami Vivekananda is telling us, that Karma Yoga has a lot to do with this philosophy, mythology and rituals. This ritual is karma. It is necessary in every religion because most of us cannot understand abstract spiritual things until we grow much spiritually. Therefore, symbols are of great help and we cannot dispense with the symbolic method of putting things before us. From time immemorial, symbols have been used by all kinds of religions. In one sense, we cannot but think in symbols. Can you think without any symbols? For example, you know, there is a cow and you use a word in English language, C-O-W, cow. As soon as somebody utters the word cow, the sound penetrates through the ear canal and enters into your brain and agitates your mind, and immediately it brings about a picture of the word cow. And you will act or react. You know, supposing you are walking in a forest and you don't know what danger is encountering you. Suddenly you hear somebody shouting behind you, "Be careful, there is a tiger. It is running after you." Immediately, you know, you didn't see the tiger. You don't even see the tiger. But as soon as you hear that word, it provokes a very powerful reaction. Immediately, it makes you do something. So words are very powerful. Actions are also very powerful because words are symbols. So this is what Swami Vivekananda is pointing out. Words themselves are symbols of thought. In another sense, everything in this universe may be looked upon as a symbol. The whole universe is a symbol and God is the reality, the essence behind. And about symbols, Swami Vivekananda says, who made these symbols? Did some people sit down and then think about them and said, we will invent certain symbols for this particular purpose? No. You see, certain symbols are universally understandable. Even animals understand it. Do you know what it is? Supposing you are passing on a road and suddenly you see a dog is there walking about and you do it. And it is likely to come to you, is it not? It understands it somehow. Nobody has taught it. But you bring out your stick and then do like this. Do you know what would be the reaction? So, do you think that the dog understands the symbol, symbolic language? It understands. Universal language, you know. As soon as you show the stick, it simply runs away from there. There are natural symbols. Some of these natural symbols, you know. You know this? I do not need to learn any language. If I do like this, then everybody understands. Or like this, you show like this. You just lift your hands and smile and say, people understand it. Put up your fist and look ferociously, glaringly at the person. He may not know what language you speak. You may not know his language, but he understands this symbol very much. You don't know, very peculiar, you know. In our village, there was a fellow who was dumb. And I don't know, we used to, as children, you know, we used to play with this. At that time, we were very ignorant people, you see. Somehow, this fellow would get very angry. If we scratch our nose, He immediately, his blood rushes to his face. He will run after us as though he is going to kill us. I don't know why. So, certain universal symbols are there. Some of these symbols have not been invented by human beings. There are some symbols which are man-made. For example, the flags, political flags. These are political symbols. These are man-made symbols. But there are certain symbols like swastika, like a cross, like a circle. Circle is most universal symbol. You will find almost in every religion, even a primitive religion. Certain symbols are universally prevalent. Many of you may think that the cross first came into existence as a symbol in connection with the Christian religion. But as a matter of fact, it existed long before Christianity was, before Moses was born, before the Vedas were given out, before there was any human record of human things. Again, the symbol of the crucified Savior, of a man crucified upon a cross, appears to have been known to almost every nation. The circle has been a great symbol throughout the world. Then there is the most universal of all symbols, swastika. Unfortunately, swastika for us today symbolizes tremendous amount of oppression, racial slaughter, because it has been misused by these Nazis. All these symbols could not have been purely conventional. There must be some reason for them, some natural association between them and the human mind. Language also is not the result of convention. It is not that people ever agreed to represent certain ideas, but certain words. There never was an idea without a corresponding word, or a word without a corresponding idea. Ideas and words are in their nature inseparable. This is one of the most fascinating subjects in philosophy. The association between words and ideas. There are three words we use. Shabda, pada, and artha. Shabda means sound. Pada means word. And artha means idea. And Tulasidas, you know, he wrote this great Ramcharitamanas. And he salutes Lord Shankara. Vagartha viva. That is, vak means word. Artha means idea. Just as these two can never be separated, so Shiva and his spouse, Parvati, cannot be separated. I salute them both. And Sri Ramakrishna reinforces the same idea. Brahman and Shakti are identical. They are obverse and reverse of the same coin. So a word and its idea. And based upon this understanding, a great philosophy has come into existence in Vedanta, and that is the basis of what is called Mantra Shastra. You know, Indians believe in mantras. You utter a word, and then that word will slowly take you to that goal. The name of God, for example, or some kind of mantras. You know, the word mantra has become universal in English language. So, mantra means that which immediately lifts up your mind to a particular idea. Of course, from the spiritual standpoint of view, mantra means it is an idea with tremendous force behind it. Some people believe just the mere utterance of a mantra, it will lift up your mind. It will produce a tremendous effect. Mantras, for example, they can stop the movements of the sun and the moon. They can bring ghosts to you. And the ghosts can do anything to you. They can carry you somewhere. They can bring something else to you. You know, this idea is there. 1001 Nights, Jinn and all that, Alauddin and the lamp and all that. Tantric scriptures are full of these ideas of mantras. And so many Buddhists, you know, they also have faith in this. That's why they introduced this tremendous mantra, you know that? Mani Padme Hum. Go on chanting that name rhythmically, and it produces its own effect. Do you think this idea of mantra is just some man-made convention? No. It is based on the experience of great souls who, as it were, found out a bridge underneath the water, and they have pointed out to us, this is the bridge. From this side to that side, there is a connection. You can safely walk by this bridge and reach the other shore. Sri Ramakrishna used to say, this mantra is like a rope. He said, he gave an illustration, supposing there is a great treasure hidden in a big river. But the treasure box is tied with a rope, and the one end of the rope is somewhere hidden on the shore, and you are in search of this treasure. So somebody is kind enough to tell you, so you dig here, you will get a rope, and catch hold of that rope and follow it. It will take you to the treasure house. So the man digs and catches hold of the rope. Slowly, with the help of it, he goes into the river until he reaches the treasure box. A mantra is like that, but not merely that. Even Sri Ramakrishna or Holy Mother used to say, Japat Siddhi. Perfection is attained through the repetition of mantra. But they used to say, in the beginning, you repeat the mantra, you catch hold of the mantra, and you follow the mantra. But after some time, the mantra catches hold of you, and it will, you need not do anything, just hold on to it. And it will carry you like a mother bird carrying its chick to the goal. There is a tremendous philosophy behind this. How and why this philosophy is there and how it works, I will discuss it in our future classes. Coming back to our subject here, the symbols to represent ideas may be sound symbols or color symbols. Now it's very interesting. Symbols are many types, not only sound symbols, not only color symbols, but there are many types of symbols are there. You know, let me give an example. Suppose there is a blind man and he cannot see. There are deaf people, they cannot hear. Suppose there is a blind and deaf and mute person. He can neither hear nor see nor speak. But even his mind is there, it can understand a symbol. So what do? You just go there and slowly catch hold of his hand and shake the hand. Immediately understands, this person who is shaking my hand is a friendly person. He is my friend. Or a child is restless. So what do? You put your hand on the back of the child and slowly pass it on. Not to speak of only children. You know animals like cats? You take it and then pass your hand. There are different spots on the bodies of different animals. Say for example, these dogs, they don't much like backside. But here, you pass your hand from here. It feels great joy there. Cats, of course, you pass from the backside, your hand. It's a symbol. What is the symbol you are giving to it? What is it? Is understanding, this person loves me. He is not harmful, not only harmful, is a very friendly person to me. It doesn't understand your language. It doesn't see any color. But with this particular gesture, it brings the tremendous understanding. See, there's color symbols are also there. Then signs are there. You know, in some places, an arrow mark means go this way. We also have here. The shrine room is here. Sometimes people enter into we say, no, that is kitchen. Don't enter there. This is, you enter here and meditate. But very often, people gravitate towards kitchen automatically. I don't know why, even though there is no sign. In the world's ritualistic symbols, we have an expression of the religious thought of humanity. It is easy to say that there is no use of rituals and temples and all such paraphernalia. Every baby says that in modern times. But it must be easy for all to see that those who worship inside a temple are in many respects different from those who will not worship there. There is a great truth in this. Those who follow rituals, they have greater chance for developing their divinity or greatness in any way than the people who scorn them, reject them. Therefore, the association of particular temples, rituals, and other concrete forms with particular religions has a tendency to bring into the minds of the followers of those religions the thoughts for which those concrete things stand as symbols, and it is not wise to ignore rituals and symbology altogether. The study and practice of these things form naturally a part of Karma Yoga. Let me end with a beautiful example. Sri Ramakrishna has a tremendous respect for the waters of the river Ganga. The waters of Ganga, I used to say, are the Brahman manifest in liquid form. Every Hindu, he respects Ganges. You know, even we bring Ganga water, and whenever we do some rituals, here Thames water is not used. Only Ganga water. We use the Thames water and then put a drop of the Ganga water there, and the whole of Thames would immediately be transformed into purest of the Ganga. Now, is it not a superstition? A man of realization who can see Brahman everywhere, why should he particularize and say, this river is most sacred river? Because it is true that the whole world is Brahman. But you can't see Brahman in sewage water. You can see Brahman, a better manifestation, in a holy man, in a beautiful spot. So the first you try to look upon beautiful things, holy things, pure things as manifestations of God, gradually progress to such a state where after there is nothing called superior, nothing called inferior, nothing called holy, nothing called unholy. Everything is holy. So Sri Ramakrishna, when he used to teach this Brahmavari, and some people they poo-pooed, oh, what is this? This is just river water. And all the sewage is being discharged into that river water everywhere. Sri Ramakrishna reinforced the idea. No, Swami Vijnanananda, he had a disciple. And he said, I thought Ramakrishna is simply because he read about it, he thought about it, he is reinforcing the idea into us. But my God, no. One day I was sitting there and suddenly I saw that actually, you know, this happened at Allahabad. Triveni, one goddess with three strands of hair, she was as though walking in the river. Then he understood that this goddess is manifesting in the form of this water. For ordinary people, it is water. But for realized souls, it is the goddess, gods and goddesses, who manifest in this particular form. Ultimately, of course, all this idea of gods and goddesses is also in the realm of duality. When we reach the highest realization, everything becomes Brahman. But until we realize that state, we have to revere certain things as better manifestations of divinity than the other. But ultimately, all differentiations must completely cease. Not by force, not by intellectual thinking, but by realization, actual experience. So, rituals, mythology and philosophy, Karma Yoga has very much to deal with it. So in our next class, I will deal about this one particular aspect, the science of mantra, why it is so important. And in every religion, these mantras, whether it is Christianity or Islam or anywhere, mantras form a very important part of spiritual discipline. So, briefly I will deal with it in my next class. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.